Welcome, everybody. It's time once again for the next chapter with Charlie Hedges. As he explores turning the page on his life and yours.
Hi, all. Charlie Hedges here, and today's show is sort of a potpourri of life learnings with a new friend, Christina Dylag. Christina is the author of a new book, Tiny Little Boxes, which is a very delightful journey into the thoughts of a brilliant young woman. The subtitle of Tiny Little Boxes reveals a bit about Christina's unique and provocative thinking. The subtitle reads, How to Cope with Existential Dread by Way of Ice Cream and Other Things. In this episode, Christina and I chat about the Velveteen Rabbit, not the book, but her very unique cocktail lounge she and her sister started in Las Vegas, Nevada for Las Vegas locals. But mostly, she and I engage in a discussion on her witty and friendly philosophical ponderings about life, the universe, and everything, to quote Douglas Adams from The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. This is such a fun show. Be prepared to chuckle and to think about life through the fresh eyes of Christina Dylag. Christina Dylag, it is such a treat to chat with you today on The Next Chapter with Charlie. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited.
Oh, me too. And our conversation that we had before was the most unusual conversation I've had before a podcast because you have so many things to say. I didn't know where to start. You are a successful entrepreneur, and we want to get into that. You are an author. And, you know, you're what seems to me an overall wise and curious human being. And there's so many things I want to talk to you about today. But let's give honor to your work. And you have a book that's just out called Tiny Little Boxes with the ever so witty subtitle of How to Cope with Existential Dread, I get it, by way of ice cream and other things. Now that's where you had me, was ice cream. That was when my producer said, you got to do a show on this because it's ice cream, because I'm an ice cream person. And it's got to be a pint at a time. I tried half pints, you know, that's a waste of time. Just a cup is a waste of time.
Go big or go home.
Well, you know, don't tell me that because I could probably go to a quart. So the first thing I think we just have to talk about is Tiny Little Boxes is published by Nihilistic Ice Cream. Now, while I'm most intrigued with the idea of Nihilistic Ice Cream, I have no idea what the hell that means. Tell me about Nihilistic Ice Cream.
Yeah, I'm a one-woman show, I suppose. So I wrote this book prior to the pandemic, so the timing of it was quite interesting. But I really wanted to come up with an interesting way to market the book, so I came up with Nihilist Ice Cream. And
oh, not nihilistic. Pardon me. I wrote it as Nihilist Ice Cream. I know that.
Well, you know, either way works. It is nihilistic, so it works too.
Okay.
Yeah, Nihilist Ice Cream. So the objective was really to kind of shock and awe, have a kind of a spectacle element to the marketing plan. So I bought a hearse, and
that's not a computer generated image. That's a real hearse.
Yeah, I bought it on Craigslist. So the whole objective was to barter ice cream in exchange for one soul. So I did that. It didn't go over that well with everyone, but it was just supposed to be a really a fun way to market the book, because ultimately all we have is the present moment. All we have is this current lifetime, and nihilism operates under the premise that we only have this lifetime, and to spend your entire life just for the sake of the afterlife is a waste, just like nihilism. Ice cream is only as good when you have it right in front of you, or else it'll melt right before your eyes. So in a nutshell, that's nihilist ice cream.
Were you actually driving the hearse around and trying to sell ice cream?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Yes? Yes?
I had some angry, because I have a phone number as well on the hearse, and there were some disgruntled people as I was driving through their neighborhoods. But yeah, I would park it, and the casket would be coming out of the back. I had the ice cream situated in the casket, and the bartering began.
So what kind of bartering? I had no intention of going here, but this is just, I knew this would take me off. So what kind of bartering, how does that work?
Yes, so one ice cream for one soul. Soul extractions are $6.66. That was for a Polaroid picture in which I would take your soul. And then existential...
Oh, in the old American Indian concept of taking a soul from a yeah. photograph?
Right, yeah. And then now that you have your existential dread, the perfect cure is Tiny Little Boxes, my book, which I would sell as like the aftercare manual. So that would be for sale as well. So it's kind of all packaged together.
So who? Okay, I'm curious, and I won't go much longer on this. But who were your buyers? What was the profile of your buyers?
People who had a good sense of humor, I would say, first and foremost. People who understood that it was just kind of tongue in cheek. So I would kind of put on a little bit of a show, and then promote the book. Especially if people started getting a little weirded out, I would just kind of cut the character and move on to the book and what it was all about, and how it's just kind of like a fun idea to sell the book.
So what was the profile of your critics?
Driving around, there were some people who would ask me to put my window down, and so I would. And they would say, I'm saving my soul for Jesus, you can't take my soul. That kind of thing, or like I'm just saving, thinking that I was actually going to try to extract their soul from them. People, maybe like a fundamentalist kind of mentality, I would assume. So, yeah.
Sentimentalist or religious.
Yeah. Yeah.
I can talk any way I want about religious, since I'm a very extremely religious person, but I'm also a cynic. So that mm-hmm. typically those two words don't go together, cynical Christian. But I guess maybe it does, but unless you're cynical about your faith, but I am cynical about my faith. I think we're going to get into that in a bit. Now, before we get more into the meat of the book, I have to tell you personally what sold me on your book. As I was reading the introduction, I realized, you are tongue-in-cheek and witty and have lots of fun in doing what you do, yet you are a philosopher. You have dealt in reading philosophy, understanding life in a much deeper level, and you describe in the introduction your influence of Plato and Kant and Nietzsche, and then you mention the oh-so-famous Anton Chigurh. I'm thinking, and I didn't read any further after I saw Anton Chigurh, Christina, so I didn't read the explanation of Anton. So I just read that saying, I know that name. I know that name. Where do I know that name? I don't think it's a philosopher, but I do think he's probably a poet. So I looked up Anton Chigurh, and he turns out to be the anti-hero, Javier Bardem, in No Country for Old Men. What in the world were you doing with that? About what did he have, a, a bullet. What was that thing called?
What was it called?
Some kind of bullet gun that he, not a bullet gun, but he would shoot something. It's in your introduction.
He's like the ultimate villain of any, I mean, as far as it stands out in my mind, he's just next level. I mean, the acting, and as well as like any Coen Brothers movie, just really sticks out to me, and the delivery is just spot on. So I just wanted something that was really like a powerful image.
Oh, he is. He is so powerful, and he survives. He's like the only one that survives, and then, well, him and Tommy Lee Jones. But everybody else, no one survives except him, just cut up, bled up, brokenness, and he still gets away. Yeah, he was, as they say in Jim Talk, he was a badass.
Yes.
So tell me, Christina, I'm wondering, you know, we live in a day where book writing, it seems like everyone wants to be an author. And there's so much, you know, I started writing a long time ago, but I haven't written a book for, you know, published. I write incessantly, but I have not published since, for 25 years, I have not published. What I'm wondering, what do you have in that clever and insightful mind of yours that you feel offers an alternative voice that my listeners and I need to hear?
Truly carving a path of your own that is free from restriction, whether that be your conditioning from family or culture, social norms, anything that keeps you restricted and confined to an identity that's not yours, really just finding your own voice and being able to live a life that you want. And that doesn't mean like all the riches in the world necessarily. It's more about finding what really calls you in, what you're magnetized to, and being able to live each day in the best way possible, the best way that's possible for you, and living by your own truth. And I don't think I'm so original in being able to express that, right? Like lots of people have said a similar thing, but I think being reminded of that is really important. And there might be a way that I deliver it that could connect to someone who may not connect with a different book of a similar nature. It's more in the self-help realm. And I know sometimes books in that genre can seem kind of removed and like high and mighty almost, self-righteous.
Yes, and very self-righteous.
I definitely did not want to come across that way. I wanted it to be very conversational and that I'm just finding my way just as you are, and maybe something that I have to share will resonate with you.
Yeah, and I think you succeed. I think... It is not your normal book. For those of us who like creativity, it is so creatively written with such wonderful insights, and your wit, and I think you told me the way you honor grammar, the grammar is very important to you, and it's obvious in your writing style that you use words and you put together phrases that are not predictable. You actually have to read your book. You know, it's not like, you know, I'm going to go through this and say, oh, I know what the next sentence is going to be, because I have no idea what the next sentence is going to say.
Makes you pay attention.
You do make you pay attention. Makes for a very slow read. but a thoroughly enjoyably slow read.
Thank you. I appreciate that so much.
I had a guest. I was just listening to a podcast preparing for an introduction by a man named Rick Stone, and we did a podcast on storytelling and the power of story. And sort of the conclusion out of that, Christina, is that we are existentially the sum of the stories we tell about ourselves.
Oh, yes.
And the power of story, I'm really, you know, I've been into story for dozens of years, but this put a new sort of framework on story for me. And he has this to say. I was just listening to the podcast on the way over to do this one, and I heard this phrase, and I really liked it, and it said, whomever, I think I'm using the word correctly, I don't think it's whoever, I think it is whomever designs your story has power over you. And for that reason, it is essential for you to redesign your own story. Because if you get a story from your parents, or if you get a story from a boss, or from, you know, society, your friends, wherever these stories, these narratives come from that we tell ourselves who we are giving other people authority to determine what we're going to do in life. You know, we happen to live in a country that allows us not to do that. Mm-hmm. You know, that gives us freedom not to do that. Yet the human proclivity is to fall into the acceptable norm, is it not?
Yes, absolutely. I think so. I mean, we do what the people around us are doing. And the beautiful part about story is that you can rewrite your story. Even if you've told yourself the same story over and over again about how things have unfolded, you still have the power to change it, to look backward and think, what was really happening here, objectively, and not so much from the perspective of perceived trauma or whatever it could be, even though, of course, trauma exists. But memory changes. Every time we look back at a memory, it's different. And we can take the power back and think of, what have I learned from the stories of my life, and put it in perspective in that way. And I think that's really powerful.
Yeah, I like that. What have I learned? And I think sometimes maybe a bit more specific about that. What have I learned about myself and about my genuine nature? What is in harmony with who I am hardwired to be on the inside, and what is in harmony with somebody else that wants me to be whatever?
Yes, absolutely, yeah.
This is right in line with it, so we're going to stay in line with the same notion. But you wrote, we settle for a destiny carved out for someone else. Who's it carved out by, Christina? Who does that carving?
I think a lot of people do. People who have something to gain by you being in line with their story. I mean, if you take for one example, the 40-hour work week or typical 9-to-5, I knew when I was very young that was not going to happen for me. I had no interest in doing that. But a lot of people subscribe to that, and there's nothing wrong with a 9-to-5, but is it what everyone truly wants to do? Work for most of their lives, typically in a job that they don't actually want. And it's kind of mindless because it's taking so much time away from things that they could be doing. And so a lot of the time, that sort of carving out of life is done because we're all fitting within this narrative that's ultimately benefiting other people. But we have the power to take it back and think, what truly works for me? What works for me? How do I want to use my time, my energy, and do that instead? But yeah, it's often people who have something to gain from having your life prescribed in such a way.
I have not thought of it that way, and I think you're so right. I think that other people have something to gain. Now, it's not always tangible gaining, you know, like in a job, they're going to get some productivity out of you, or in a marriage, they're going to get their way over your way. But the one thing they get about it, if you fall into line with what they think, they get self-affirmation. They get clarity and security, knowing that what they think is right. Because if I told Christina about this and she bought it, it indeed must be a good idea. There's sort of a personal resolution or a personal satisfaction that I am on the right track, even though I'm not, that other people are following along. I think the tendency, the human tendency, is to follow. I don't think our tendency is to break out of that norm, because it's dangerous territory, isn't it? It's fearful territory, because I'm fond of saying, in bad situations or abusive situations, a bad known is better than any unknown, because we're so afraid of the unknown, we can at least predict the bad known. We know what it's going to be, but if we can't predict it, we could come up with a worse known, and we're scared to death of that, and that's why frequently we won't change.
I think also another aspect of it is a survival tendency, wanting to fit in with the tribe, and we don't want to be excluded. It's like deep within us to want to feel accepted. So what's the best way to do that is to go along with what everyone else is doing. I think it's just so hardwired in us to do that, that we're willing to sacrifice part of ourselves in favor of the collective in that way.
So is it then only the remnant or the rebellious that really do seek what you're suggesting and what I endorse, and this is not something every American is going to jump onto, that there are just a handful of people that will resonate with this and say, no, I don't want to be like everybody else? What do you think?
That's a good question. I mean, I don't think that authenticity is always rebellion. I think that there are parts of our truth that do resonate with the collective, and there are parts that do not. So it's up to us individually to decipher what those two elements are. It's hard, though, because, I mean, we've been conditioned our whole entire lives, are conditioned every day, every moment that we look around at advertisements and magazines, social media, everything is conditioning us in some way. So it's really about removing and seeing, okay, where do I begin, and the rest of this stuff somewhere else. it's a tricky thing.
It is a tricky thing, and another one of the scary things that you had mentioned is, if I do go out on my own, will I be, according to my truest inner self, whatever that may be, and the discovery of that is not so simple, but but when I do that, what if I am not accepted? What if I have a harder time getting a job because I'm not playing the game? There is a sense of life identity at stake here as well. Do I sacrifice my personal identity to live well cooperatively, or do I live well cooperatively sacrificing my self-identity? Do you think that
does
is
it
have a question?
To be either or?
I don't know. That's the question. Let's talk about that.
There's definitely a fear. I mean, no matter what, there will be fear involved. But I think the sacrifice will yield rewards as well. The moment you trust in what can happen for you, I feel like so many opportunities will open up. But it's that trust element that has to be present.
I believe in, because we'll talk about it a bit, I have a strong theological part of me. And I believe we are created by design, and we're created uniquely. And I think the closer we live to that creative design, or non-religious terms, it's in our hardwiring, the closer we are to that, the more content we're going to be with our lives and the better off we are in our lives. And that does require moving closer to who we really are. What I want to do is I want to start going on the barriers and the difficulties of getting there. But before we do that, I think it's time for us to take a break. So we can just talk about, I can't wait to talk about the Velveteen Rabbit. I won't tell anybody about the Velveteen Rabbit. but we'll start. we will start the second half of the show with the Velveteen Rabbit. Until then, let's take a quick break, okay?
Wonderful.
Hi there, this is Charlie Hedges, and you're listening to The Next Chapter with Charlie and my very special guest, Christina Dylag, with her book, Tiny Little Boxes, and the great subtitle, How to Cope with Existential Dread by Way of Ice Cream and Other Things. And are you prepared to sell your worn-out, tired soul for a cup of ice cream?
Yeah, are you?
You know, I just may be. There's no telling. But you know what I want to do now is, let's give an example. Let's tell a story of how you discovered a sense of opportunity, something that would fulfill who you were. But it happened in a very interesting way, and you told me of an experience of where you traveled to, I recall, Thailand and India, and what was the other country?
In Nepal.
And Nepal, and you did some work in meditation, and you did this very intense 10-day, 10-hour, couple meals a day, no talking, eye contact, and you did a retreat. Tell me about that retreat, and tell me about the conclusions of that retreat.
Yes, it's interesting that you brought up story as well, because that was such an important element of that experience, being in meditation for that long. At hour 8, 9, you really want to rip your hair out because all you have is you and your brain and trying to shut it off. And of course, that's a difficult task. And I found myself telling the same story over and over again, trying to recap a story, different resolutions to a story that had happened, and wondering, well, if it went this way or that way, would have happened. And it was agonizing, the ongoing conversation with myself about this story and what happened. And finally, I came to the revelation, it doesn't matter. Nothing matters except this moment, because what happened already happened. There's no other conclusion except what prevailed. And all we have now is the moment. And
let's pause there. How long ago was that?
Oh, that was before the bar. So that was 10 years ago.
10 years ago. And mindfulness and present oriented were not the popular, so you predated the big movement of mind, you know, presence and mindfulness. This came to you before this was the phrase du jour that it is today.
Yeah, I stumbled upon it for sure. Of course, it's been around for a while, but as far as its huge boom recently,
right? The present is the only thing that matters, or the essential thing that matters.
Yes, and then also I was released then from any stories that were keeping me from what I wanted to do or how I wanted to live. I had an idea to work for myself and a cocktail bar, and I was pretty young at this time, I think 23, 24, and I thought, I don't have the experience to open a bar prior to this experience. I'm not old enough, I don't know what I'm doing, and then I felt released from all of that, thinking, if I work hard enough, I can come up with the funds, I can figure out how to do this, there's always a solution to every problem, and I'll just ask questions, and I'll figure it out. So I came up with the idea for Velveteen Rabbit Cocktail Bar, and I pitched the idea to my sister, who was totally on board. And I cut my trip short after 5 months. I was planning on doing a year, and moved back to Vegas, to Las Vegas, my hometown, and lived with my parents, saved a lot of money, and I was so naive about how much effort it was going to take, but that was ultimately in my benefit because after a while I was kind of stuck. So I made it work, and I'm so happy that finally it came to fruition. But yeah, that was basically what happened after that meditation retreat.
But this Velveteen Bar is not just, you know, the hangout for local Las Vegas. There's a special quality. I mean, I saw your recommendations, and it's from extremely credible sources. I mean, you know, Savoie, New York Times, Journal. I can't recall all. I'm just going off the memory of my head. I don't have them written down. Mm-hmm. But you've received several brilliant reviews. What is unique about your bar?
Well, growing up in Las Vegas, there really wasn't much in the way of independently owned bars and restaurants. It was a lot of chain restaurants and strip malls, and it was a place that everyone wanted to leave, basically, because the entire energy of Las Vegas was focused on the strip, of course, and tourism. And so when we decided to open the bar, we wanted to create something that was truly unique for the city. And we wanted it to be community-driven, focused on art, craft cocktails, innovative recipes, and just a place that felt very warm and inviting, and much like the nostalgia of Velveteen Rabbit, the children's book.
Right.
And so I think we accomplished that. It was definitely something that was there to find in Las Vegas at that time.
How fun. And I saw on your Facebook that you sell ice cream.
Yes. So Nihilist ice cream. So, you know, I'm creating these funnels for myself. So, yeah, I sell the ice cream. And then when people receive the ice cream, it comes with a flyer that kind of outlines what the book is about. And then they can purchase my book in the vending machine. So it's a one-stop shop. Velveteen Rabbit.
That is very, very cool. I don't get to Las Vegas that frequently, but I will definitely call you and meet you at the Velveteen Rabbit.
And, yes, you should, definitely.
I don't drink, but I can eat plenty of ice cream.
We have mocktails. We can make you something special.
Okay. You know, now let's go to the difficult times of this. And in your subtitle, you write about existential dread. Quoted Sartre, so you probably got Sartre and, what is her name, Simone de Beauvoir, his wife or girlfriend. I don't know if they were married. What are you getting at with existential dread and not living according to the way you were built, getting out of a tiny little box that was forced on you by someone else or was suggested to you and you bought their suggestions? Let's don't say forced. You know, they suggested and created a tiny little box for you that you slipped into. But along with it comes existential dread. Can you explain that to me?
In my mind, existential dread is when you feel disconnected from yourself. And it can come up in many different ways. So I think it's particular to every individual what that looks like. But it's just a feeling of not truly being alive, the vitality that comes with being alive and truly being present in this experience of being human. I thought existential dread also was just an interesting way to package that whole notion. And then, of course, COVID happened, so the pandemic seemed to team nicely with the conceptual nature of this book. So, yes.
Existential dread is so Sartre.
Yes. Yes.
It doesn't have to be. It can, you know, living in the present, living according to the way that you are built, in consideration of other human beings. The mystics are very strong on that. You are very knowledgeable of God. You're very knowledgeable of yourself. But if it is not demonstrated in your relationship with people, it's all BS. It doesn't it doesn't mean anything. You know, this is a counter to existential dread is human relationship and human well-being. You are prone to challenge the rote status quo in favor of actually thinking through the stuff that we are saturated with first as kids. And then, you know, we talk about being put in a little box by our parents and by, you know, whatever institutions we're a part of. But it goes on throughout our life. You know, we're conditioned by the sports teams we're on. We're considered, you know, that our kids are on. We're conditioned by our jobs. We're conditioned by our families. For those of us that are married or have significant others, we're conditioned by that. All of these conditioning, you really talk a lot about self-reflection. And in your mindfulness and meditation, you know, I get that you are a self-reflecting person. What do you think the value, I mean, or not the value, we know the value. What is the difficulty of spending time alone with yourself? Why do people not like that?
That's a good question. Our minds are always going, and I think the easy thing to do is try to escape, and that comes in many forms. Social media is a huge one now. Any activity that really keeps us in almost like hypnosis. And when we're alone with ourselves, we're faced with the frenetic energy of what's really moving inside of us. And I think that's really powerful, what's happening. And to navigate through it is quite an ordeal sometimes, especially if we've been through a lot, or, well, just the human condition in general. So sorting through it is not always fun. Growth is not always this really uplifting experience, but on the other end of it, it's so freeing. So I think just the human condition, we're always subjected to it, and when we're alone with ourselves, we're faced with it. And that's sometimes very confronting.
What about busyness? You know, I mean, what about those who would like to try to get in touch with themselves, but, you know, they've got three kids, they've got a job, they've got, you know, where in the world do they find time to do this thing that you and I both value, of solitude and reflection, solitude and silence and reflection? Where do they find time for that, Christina?
Well, I think anything can be meditation as well, just being present in what you're doing when you're relating to someone, when you're having a conversation, when you're doing the dishes, when you're driving in your car. That presence is meditation. And to be alone with yourself is, I mean, you're always with yourself. So starting the day with like 5 minutes to be alone with yourself and set the stage for the day by being present, and then just allowing that to be something continual throughout your day through every activity that you do.
You know, in my economy, in order to do that well, it almost needs to be ritualized. If it's not, it doesn't happen. That when I wake up after I do this, I'm going to spend just 5 minutes sitting somewhere and doing it. And if I don't make that a habit, it will be a nice little weekly foray, you know?
Yes.
An affair with isolation.
I agree. I think it should definitely be programmed into your day or your week. I think that's also why church is always on every Sunday. It's a good reminder and allowing you to come back to yourself, you know, if religion is something that you're into. But I don't really see a difference between spirituality and being religious. I think they're one in the same. There's truth in everything. There's truth in every system, every program, every kind of major overarching thought pattern. There's truth in everything, and it's a matter of getting through all the distortion of the human experience and how we've presented it in the world. But there's truth at the core in everything.
I like that, the distortion of everything that's happening to us in the world, because I think there is value in everything, but I also think institutions are going to give us false values and devalue us and put us into a box that does not allow creative thinking.
Yes.
And I'm with you on religion, believe it or not. You know, I'm a devout theist, steeped in the tradition and philosophies of the late medieval traditions of Christian mysticism and contemplative prayer, which is very different than the church today, because the church today is very transactional. The church today is you do this, you get that, you do this, you get that. Well, that's far from the late medieval mystics. You know, this is all about unity and oneness with God and understanding God and goodness and help and service of other people. You know, there's not a transactional piece to it. Now there are transactional, I can't say there's not a transactional piece. There is a transactional piece, but your faith and your relationship with the divine is not a transactional. It is an ontological and essential nature of who you are.
That's amazing. I'm such a proponent for that. Yeah.
Yeah, and I recognize today that often religion narrows our points of view as opposed to what I'm calling expanding our views to stages of wonder. It's just not expanding our views to, okay, now I'm not Darwinian, I'm going to become Mark Darwinian. I could care less. I could give a rat. but expanding our consciousness to stages of wonder, that is what, for me, see, that's what religious traditional Christianity brings to the table. It's always expanding my view of love, my view of relationship, and my view of unity with the cosmos. It's a beautiful thing. And now I'm going to ask you to talk about the negative now, because it really does fit into this who we are as a person, who we genuinely are. And you write a bit, as I was reading some of the materials, you write a bit about sin and damnation and truth. What are the dangers of sin and damnation? I mean, they're big in the Bible. You know, I can't say as a Christian they're not big in the Bible. They're big in the Bible. Where do you see the dangers there?
Of sin?
Sin and damnation and hell and heaven and all that stuff.
Well, I talk a lot about those concepts. Oftentimes I'm kind of flipping them on their heads because I wanted to include a lot of terminology that's so full of baggage, that we use them loosely, and oftentimes it doesn't really have any bearing on anything. That's why I also use the term God quite frequently, and of course, God appears in so many different religious traditions, sometimes under a different name, but it's all the same thing at the core. A lot of the time when I'm using those terms, it's often to point at how they're full of baggage and they're not really real, because sin, we've been taught, have been something that we repress within ourselves, and I truly believe that we're meant to look into the darkness and see what shadows reside there and make friends with them so that we're not repressing things and we're able to live a whole life, wholeness being a culmination of what's deemed dark and or light, so that we can utilize to our betterment.
You just sounded very Jungian. I don't know if he's one of your guys or not, but that's a very Jungian concept, and I so agree with that. We must enter into the darkness, you know, and I've had some very dark periods of my life, and those perhaps really were greater learnings than the high parts of my life. I took so much more away from that of what I don't want, what is not good for me, things that I actually that actually came from me, that I did these certain things that were probably not healthy, but I learned from that and I don't do them. It was my ability to be a father, and I think I was an okay father, but I learned to be an okay father by not being fathered okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I learned kind of what not to do. Now, we're getting close to wrapping up, and I want to get to a subject that is a subject of an entire podcast.
Okay, great. Let's do it.
And I want to talk to you because you are big on truth. And when we were talking on the phone, I could not figure out my statement, but I figured out my statement since then, Christina. So now I can give you an idea on truth, because Terry Hershey and I, a friend of mine, did a podcast on truth. And this was our debate. And this has to do with, it really impacts personal values, personal goals and opportunities. And this is a sort of a, how do you see truth? Do you believe something because it is true, or is something true because you believe it? Do you believe something because it's a standalone truth, or does it become a standalone truth simply as a result of your belief in it? Do you get that question?
I think the latter.
Yeah, I do too. I do too. And anytime I debate with someone on this, and they say, well, I believe in truth, and I say, define it. And they'll define it. Yeah. I said, how do you know? Well, because science...
How did they know that it was a truth before believing in it?
How does it do what?
How can you establish that it's truth if you believe in a truth that already exists? Then you're believing in it, right? So how can you establish that that truth exists outside of your belief in it?
Yeah, we're on the same page on that. I believe there is an absolute truth out there. Because, you know, in my belief in deity and my belief in that construct, but I believe we can't know it. All we can do is know about truth. I can know a lot about truth, but I can't know truth itself. Because I am too flawed and too broken, and the world is too damn confusing.
We only know 4% of the universe. It's such an egotistical thing for humans to think that we know everything.
Do we know that much? Truth. I didn't think we knew that much.
Yeah, exactly. We hardly know anything. And so it's strange to me that we think we have any idea of what's really happening on a large scale. I mean, the concept of truth or any of these huge concepts, you know, it's how could we really believe that we've landed on it? It's much too large for anything that we can really grasp with our human brains. I think we're just limited.
Yeah.
I'm a single human.
And I think that explains and supports your book of Tiny Little Boxes is that even our own truth, we can't know that truth until we experiment with it, until we test it. And then we can say, oh, yeah, that worked. Oh, nope, that didn't work. Let's go out and try to fail again. But if you just accept a certain biased, community-oriented, tribal-oriented truth, we end up like everybody else. We end up part of the herd. And I don't want to be part of the herd. It doesn't work for me. It works for some people.
Oh, I just think it's possible, too, that our truths can be different and they both be correct for us individually. It's okay to have parallel truths that are existing in the world. Like I feel like that's how it should be, that we each have our own individualized truth that we're living out in a way that's unique to us and that really speaks to us.
Yes, parallel and opposed.
Yes,
parallel and opposed.
Absolutely.
Truth. Yeah.
Yeah.
Very much. I tell you what, Christina, we would be buddies if we lived in Las Vegas because we think so much alike.
I agree.
I so strongly believe in that, and I've listened to physicists and read on physicists about that, and that all of life, all of truth, must be a compound of two opposing truths, and the scientists that are the physicists, the Nobel laureate physicist, says all we have to do is look at light. Is it matter? Is it wave? And the answer is yes, depending on how you look at it. Both truths are true, and yet they are polar opposites. They cannot be. And so we must accept, and that has helped me theologically. That's helped me theologically so much to hold two opposing truths. That I read two opposing things in the Bible, and I think that holds truth in my life, in that I may hold two opposing truths of what's good in my life, but I must at some time make an experiment and try something different. And my wife doesn't want me to say my age anymore, but I'm 2 months from 72, and I'm like a 27-year-old changing all the time.
I love that.
You know, whatever comes across my mind. But we are running near time, but I do want to wrap up with something. I think it's really important, and it's sort of the practical steps of this. And I'd like to know what, you know, you would consider some significant processes. I'm speaking Canadian processes. You suggest we might employ to reboot or reset our own operating systems so that we might be available to live in accordance with the ways in which we're hardwired. What are some processes you suggest? Besides reading, well, let's say read your book.
Yeah, read my book and get back to me. I'm just kidding. Yeah, it's interesting because you can understand all of this stuff on a conceptual level or intellectual level, but how practically does it live out in your everyday experience? And I think the first step, as we touched on before, is being able to be alone with yourself, venture into that silence and nurture that presence within yourself. That's first and foremost. And then also just kind of taking an inventory of how you're living every day and what is truly lighting you up and how present are you in your everyday experience? Are there things that you can cut out? Are there things that you can nurture more often? And really being able to decipher, you know, what works for you and what doesn't. I think that's kind of a practical approach to starting to incorporate some of these concepts into your life.
I like that. I heard a thing, no, I didn't hear, I read it, I read something in one of my morning devotionals today, and it talked about planning your day, and I would assume it, you know, it's about planning your year, or your, I don't know about life planning, that's pretty big. But there's a question, are you planning what you wish to do, or are your plans consumed by what others expect you to do? And if you were to write your list and then put down those things that you want to do and what's expected of you, I would assume that so many of us would have little of what we want to do and what is expected. Now, if you've got a job, there are things that are expected that you have to you have to do. But, you know, in family situations and personal situations, there's so many things. Oh, I've got to have more friends. We need to go out to dinner more. We need to do, and the question is all that, why? You know, what is driving that? If you need to get out, well, I need to get out. Let's figure out a way to get out. You know, doesn't the specificity of it doesn't matter. I like that question of planning each day very egocentrically. What do you want to do today? What would make today a bitchin' day, you know?
Yes, I love that.
Yeah.
Weeding out all those shoulds.
Oh, my goodness.
The should. I should do this. I should do that. What? Yeah, exactly. Why? What's the crux of it? What am I getting out of this? Being able to weed those out, definitely.
That's really critical. Well, I'll tell you what, Christina Dialag, wow, you are special, and I genuinely encourage our listeners to read your book, Tiny Little Boxes. I will include a link on the show notes. And, you know, Christina, I'd love to consider a part two sometime if you're willing that we will.
Oh, yes, I would love that. Thank you. Yeah, this has been so much fun.
Yeah, we'll get into more philosophy. I find so few times I can talk philosophy. And, you know, I don't know if it bores my listeners or not, but it doesn't bore me. It gets me
excited. Me neither. I love it. All day.
all day, yeah. Okay, thank you so much. You've been absolutely tremendous. Hang on the line after we're done here. I also want to thank our listeners for tuning into The Next Chapter with Charlie. And please be sure to check us out at our website, thenextchapter.life. And until next, this is Charlie Hedges signing off. Bye for now.